Shrink Wrap Radio number 381, Dreams as Guides to the Soul, with Stephen Fox.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Stephen Fox about his use of dreams in his private psychotherapy practice. Dr. Stephen Fox is a private practice licensed psychologist with over 25 years' experience. He recently authored the book, Dreams, Guide to the Soul. This book formulates 40 rules to describe a method of dream interpretation he acquired from Jungian analysts and his own clinical practice as a dream interpretation therapist. He says, quotes, "Having this book at the beginning of my practice would have reduced the amount of time it took me to get to where I am now as a dream interpretation therapist by at least 10 years, close quote. It was his intention to develop a system of dream interpretation that was teachable and relied on Jungian concepts. It was while recovering from complications from an experimental treatment for multiple sclerosis, which was ultimately successful, that Fox had a recurring dream that facilitated his recovery and led to his fascination with dreams and their meanings. Dr. Fox and his wife Deborah Brogan, a board-certified psychiatrist, currently share a private practice office in Mesa, Arizona, and his blog can be found at drfoxblog.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Stephen Fox, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm honored to be here.
Well, Stephen, I'm so glad to have you on the show, both because I'm interested in the topic of dreaming, as you know, and because you've been a longtime listener to Shrink Wrap Radio and also a financial supporter. So I thank you for that.
Oh, I'm happy to do it. I think you provide such a valuable service.
Well, just out of curiosity, do you recall how you first discovered Shrink Wrap Radio?
I think I was taking continuing educations through the Zur Institute that come through you also.
Oh, okay.
And I find those just immensely helpful. They're interesting and they're not boring, and you listen to them and you can do things, you know.
Yeah, well, that's great. Now, I discovered that you and I have something in common that I wasn't aware of, and I wonder if you were, which is you did your doctoral work in clinical psychology at the University of Montana in Missoula, and that's where I got my master's degree. At the time, they didn't have a doctoral program in clinical psychology. Since I was there maybe 10 years before you were, I was there from 1962 to 1964. Did you know we had that in common?
I had seen in your background that the University of Montana was in your background, but I didn't know you went to school there. I thought maybe you taught there.
Ah, yeah. So I don't even know if any of the same faculty were still around, you know. Well, sometime after you graduated from Montana State University and became licensed and were actually in private practice, you were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. How did that diagnosis come about, and what was the impact upon you psychologically and professionally?
First word is devastating. The second word is talking about the symptoms. I started, this is January of 1991, I started dropping things. I'd be holding drinks, and they would drop spontaneously from my hands.
Oh, yeah.
I started having numbness, but the most distressing symptom, especially as a therapist, was my voice was slurred. My voice has never been great, but, you know, it wasn't intelligible. My balance was poor. You know, that was during the attack. The attack, they treated it, and that it is relapsing and remitting, and so it went away. And I've never really had a great attack like that since, probably because of the medications I was taken, which prevent attacks.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. Now, one of the things that made me want to interview you is that you've said that your dreams played an important role in your remission from multiple sclerosis. Do I have that right?
Yeah. And basically, MS is how I came to Jungian therapy. I'd always been interested in dreams and did a type of interpretation, but following the Jungian analyst has been, of course, a great enriching experience. You know, what I found in personal therapy with the Jungian analyst is that frequently dreams would give opinions about medications or exercises or alternative means.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Are there any specific dreams that you recall as helping you to recover from multiple sclerosis that you could share with us here?
Oh, for sure. I think this one is described in the book. This was probably the most dramatic one.
Okay.
I was in karate, and I'd been in karate several years, and I was a red belt, and I was getting ready to test for the brown belt, and I was in the studio, and I was losing my balance, and they said, there's something wrong. This was before the attack. So basically, it started out with physical symptoms, and of course, those were very bothersome, particularly when you're to the point where you really can't walk decently.
Yeah.
Okay. And I used to be a long-distance runner.
Oh, wow.
I asked my dreams. I was getting a little bit better, and I thought maybe I could chance running. Okay?
Yeah.
But I was afraid to do it because I was going to go crashing in the gravel.
Sure.
I wanted to do that.
Right.
So I asked my dreams. I said, when I am ready to run, I want a physical indication that this is so. And I had a dream that I did a flying roundhouse kick,
mm-hmm.
which is probably the hardest kick to do in karate. And I went out and ran, and it went well.
Wow, that's great. I actually have a story of my own that's very similar to that, that I think I related in some past episode. And in mine, and I wasn't due to dream incubation, but I'd wanted to ride a century on my bike, 100 miles. But I had kind of chronic aches and pains in my neck, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly. I could be confounding things here. But I know that at some point I had a what I would consider to be a really big dream in which I had a bowl in my hand and there was kind of a rainbow thing going up into the sky and I could rotate it around and it was very magical.
Yeah, and, I mean, dreams are just amazing. I mean, they will signal when you're healing, too. I was in the hospital with an infection. Part of my cure was they turned my immune system off, essentially, since all, you know, multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease.
Yes.
But I got an infection because they turned it off too much, okay?
Wow.
And I was in pretty bad shape, and I had a dream one night that Native American medicine men were dancing around my bed, and I could hear the rattles shaking. And when I woke up in the morning, I felt better, and I was discharged fairly shortly after that.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And by the way, the coda to my dream was that there was this female figure, kind of a chiropractor, and I heard a voice saying, something like, accept your healing. And so it was shortly right after that that I decided, okay, I'm going to ride, go on this 100-mile bike ride.
Yeah, you know, when you hear a voice in a dream like that, your subconscious is more or less saying, you know what, I'm going to give you the message direct.
Yeah, it's powerful when that happens. Now, your book is quite different from other books written by psychologists on dreams, I think. Inasmuch as you seem to say that you can go directly to the heart of understanding the dream without it requiring a lot of time or associations from your client. For example, you say you can often work 4 to 6 dreams within a single therapy session. Do I have that right?
That's correct. I think my professors would die to hear me say that.
Yeah, right.
We used to spend an hour or two on one dream.
Yes.
In private practice, people want to use time efficiently, of course. I actually have people who bring lists. They collect dreams for a period of time, and they bring lists to me, and I interpret them. Now, I'm not getting all the fine detail of the dream, but my contention is that if you give a person the gender and the age of the dreamer, there's some basic things from Jungian psychology that you should be able to say.
Well, I agree with you about that, and it's sort of the I don't know how to say this, the sort of popular cant in the therapeutic world is that you must have the person's associations, but it, like you, I've been listening to dreams for a long time, and there's somewhere, you know, I at least can get into the general ballpark, I would say, very quickly, just based on hearing the dream.
Exactly. I mean, you want to get the associations, of course, but there's sometimes there's a symbol that's so strikingly common to the culture that you're going to come fairly close to the meaning, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I realized as I went further in your book that most of these were people that you were seeing in therapy. And as a result, perhaps you had a lot of background already in terms of knowing their history and the issues that they were working.
For sure. That helps a lot. You know, in graduate school, sort of the way they taught us dream interpretation was they had us in a classroom with a professor who was good at dream interpretation. And I don't think a method was really taught to us. It was there was a method of sorts, and I think Jungian analysts have a method, but it is very complicated, and it takes 10 years to learn it. And basically, I don't think a method was ever taught. I'm not trying to list each symbol and say this means that for the most part. I'm trying to list of 40 principles, I would say, about how to approach a dream.
Yeah, and boy, you were lucky to have a class like that in graduate school. I certainly didn't have that. I don't know how many programs actually offer that sort of thing. So I think you were lucky in that respect, and that it kind of got you, it set you off on this journey. Now, one of the subtitles on the cover of your book is 40 Ancient Secret Keys to Healing, Renewal, and Power. And I don't know that we'll make it through all 40 keys in this interview. Besides, we don't want to give listeners an excuse not to buy the book.
Okay.
But do I understand you to say that if a person has really understood these keys, they'll be able to understand their own dreams and those of others?
I think so. I have had people who have read the book who they're meeting me for the first time, and they've read my book, and they tell me a dream, and they say, this is my dream, and this is what you're going to say. And what they say is pretty close to what I would say.
That's fine.
And I'm so pleased with that.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine that would be very gratifying. Well, before we get into some of the keys, why is it you call them ancient, and why secret?
They're secret in the sense of just being unknown.
You mean not widely known?
Not widely known. It's known by the Jungian analysts. I think I'm saying ancient in the sense that these aren't things that aren't known. People do acquire this knowledge. It just takes a long time to do it. My hope with the book is that I can cut 5 years off the process of learning this.
Yeah, you say that it took you 10 years or more to really develop any confidence.
I thought I was okay. I always thought I was okay, but I didn't feel really good about dreams until I'd been doing it for 10 years. And I didn't really feel that I was delivering more than common sense until I'd been doing it for 20.
Yeah. Wow.
So I think to cut 5 years off that, you know, like I say, we had a class, but the problem was it was too much of a fishing expedition. And that's really what a lot of the books are right now, is they give you a method to help the client interpret the dream. And you take the client as the authority and the sole authority often, and basically you throw out an intuitive hypothesis, and you judge as to whether you hit the mark as to how the client reacts. Now you can interpret dreams that way, of course, but it takes a long time.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I like about your book is that it is so richly illustrated with the dreams of others and your own. So please feel free to throw in any dreams or stories that seem relevant here as we move along. Now, the first key you mentioned is what Freud referred to as day residue. And it's so easy to just stop, you know, to stop there with just a recognition that, oh, yes, I see how this relates to something that happened yesterday. But what's your advice for getting beyond the obvious and going deeper with the day residue?
You know, basically, during the day, there's a million things you could think about, okay? Dreams are always current simply because they do use the day residue. There's something that happened recently that reminded you of an earlier time, okay?
Yes.
And the important thing is finding the thread that connects those two events. There is a thread, and it's finding that thread.
Yeah, because, you know, in my own sort of looking at my own dream life and working with students in teaching a dreams class, I've never failed to find that there was something in the previous day that's in that dream, but it's usually something rather small and that would seem to be, off the main message of the dream. And that's why I think it's kind of easy to just ignore that thread and not search for it.
Well, one of the 40 keys is everything means something. You know, if I make a mistake, it's because I've underinterpreted a dream. Any given symbol can mean at least three or four different things. I tell people I really don't have to be that good in some ways, because if I only have to hit one of them. Mm-hmm. And if I miss it, and if I'm doing this with a client that I'm seeing on an ongoing basis, your subconscious will return to it and will give it to us again, usually in a different form, until we do get it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I really believe that's the case. Now, one of your keys has to do with paying attention to the gender of the figures that appear in our dreams. And you write that for both males and females, dreams use men as a code to represent an action part of a dreamer's psyche, while women usually represent an emotional portion of the dreamer's mind. I must say, I've never thought about it in quite that way, though it certainly seems plausible to me. May I ask where you got that idea?
I think it does differ from the classic Jungians that I basically am taking a more equal opportunity approach, if you will, simply because I find that dreams use men and women as code. Okay, and what we call masculinity and femininity is related to biology, in of course, in many ways, but in some ways it's not. For instance, we all know what people mean when they say there's an effeminate man or a masculine woman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these are qualities. Okay, so within any dreamer, there's different mixtures of femininity and masculinity. And the dream is using masculine and feminine. I mean, we could call it yin and yang, but masculine and feminine is simply what's before your subconscious that's easy to use.
Yeah, it was, you know, as I read through many of the dreams that you gave from your therapeutic experience, and you would put this principle into action, because it wasn't clear to me, you know, okay, well, just how would I work if the male is the action part of the dreamer and the female is the emotional portion, you know, how would that work? But you illustrated it amply in the dreams that you worked with.
You know, I want to say that, you know, I call this the first level of dream interpretation, where each part is a different part of the person's psyche.
Yes.
And that is easily the most difficult part, to think of each character as being an action or primarily an emotion, and this is intrapsychic within the person. It's not common sense, and you come up with things, and frequently I will come up with a question based on what's occurring in that way, simply because you enter an endless hall of mirrors in some ways.
Yeah.
And no matter how long I've done this, there is such a temptation to jump to the interpersonal. And I can sometimes do that when I've known a client a long time, okay? But it's usually a mistake to do it without at least considering the first one.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I found that people who are, you know, who haven't been trained in dream work or have no experience with it, they always go to the interpersonal, you know. I had this dream about my cousin, and you know, and why did I dream that I was angry at my cousin? You know, I feel like we have a good relationship. And so instead of looking at it as two parts of their inner world, they really go straight to, it's about me and my cousin.
Yeah. And really, what it would amount to in that case is she's angry with the part of herself that is like her cousin, probably.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Now, beyond gender, I found your ideas about the sex act itself in dreams very interesting. Yeah. I'm thinking of the dream that you relate in Chapter 1, which concludes with a massive orgy. Do you remember what you made of that? Can you share that with us?
Yes. Well, again, it's related to the masculine-feminine principle, and it's related to going to the first level and considering each character a part of the person's psyche. If men are your actions and women are your emotions, and there's a massive orgy taking place, and sex is a symbol of integration, what it means is your emotions and actions are happily integrating.
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting take on that. Very interesting take.
Yeah.
Now, you also emphasize the importance of recognizing parental introjects, that is, the parts of our parents that we almost swallow whole in terms of their behaviors and attitudes. So you emphasize the importance of recognizing those parental introjects in the dream.
Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us a bit more about that, and how can one know when that's the key thing that's going on?
You know, it's primarily Freudian, but if you look at any theory in mental health, eventually it gets back to parents. We say the child introjects images of the father and mother into the subconscious. I think that becomes a starting point or a basis for actions or emotions. And I want to say, it doesn't always have to be the biological parents. Whoever cared for you in that way. And if you didn't have an appropriate parent, the person, I mean, can even create their introject, and they will create their introject. They will have models of action in their world, and they will construct an action introject from that. They will have emotionally supportive relatives or friends, and they will make that their emotional introject. And I think this is a process that continues throughout life. I mean, it's Freudian in the sense that probably the basis of it is early influences, but I believe it can change over time, too.
Okay. You know, I find a lot of what you bring to this work in your book is very creative and kind of unique. You have your own unique spin on ideas that I thought I was familiar with, but you bring something unique to it. For example, I've always associated large bodies of water and dreams with the unconscious, but you make some finer distinctions, saying the ocean typically is the unconscious, land is conscious events, and the beach is the semi-conscious, or where the unconscious meets the conscious. You go on to say that a person strolling along an ocean beach in the dream is typically trying to sort out his or her conscious and unconscious issues. So I love that differentiation and specificity of your ideas. How is it that you arrive at these? You probably don't know.
Listening to your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
but if you think about it, I mean, when you're walking along the beach, I mean, isn't that the perfect time to try to put things together, too? I mean,
sure.
I think it's symbolic, and I think it's practical, too. And I think and that's a condensation of both of those things, and you run into that with dreams, and that's why I love dreams.
Yeah, it certainly makes a metaphorical sense, but, you know, as I say, you kind of bring a specificity to it that I think is kind of unique in your presentation, and gives this book a unique status, I think.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Now, paying attention to animals in your dreams is another key to understanding the dreams. What's your understanding of the significance of animals? And maybe in that connection, too, I'm going to ask you to read Dream 4B and your interpretation of it.
Okay. This goes back to the basic Freudian idea that animals are usually your basic instincts. I go on at some length about how the different animals tend to represent different kinds of instinct. The dream you mentioned, I call it taking the venom out of emotion. A 46-year-old man dreamt he was in his backyard. He netted a fish-like, poisonous creature from the swimming pool. The creature was half fish and half snake. He eventually herded the creature out of his backyard and into an alley. And the interpretation starts out with recognizing that water is almost always emotion, with a swimming pool indicating that the emotion is response to other people, that it is man-made, and that it is close to home. Aquatic creatures such as fish represent subconscious energy and resources. The snake in this dream was poisonous, and snakes often represent change and transformation because snakes are one of the few animals that completely shed their skin. The dream indicated that he was using his emotional energy to change by directing his venom, his poisonous emotions and anger, away from home where it would not hurt anyone. You know, the swimming pool, I mean, that's another example. You want to think about how the water is being handled.
Yeah. So it's not the ocean, but it's a body of water that's attached to the home.
Yeah. You know, I present at a community college here locally every so often, and I'd like to start out with the simplest dream I can think of. And the dream is a man's in a bar, and he drinks a very satisfying glass of water, and he's just so pleased with drinking that glass of water. And then I ask the students, what do you think that can mean if water is emotion? And they look at me, and then I say, well, the setting often tells you what the dream is going to be talking about. It occurred in a bar. What do you make of that? And then they get it, and they say, you know, the issue is alcoholism, probably, or drinking too much. Water is emotion. Drinking it out of a container, it's contained emotion that you're controlling, that you're taking in at an appropriate rate, and you're very satisfied with it. It turned out the person had just completed 45 days of being sober.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly helps to know what's going on in the person's life. Because, you know, I guess my main take on dreams is that they are definitely a metaphorical way of commenting on what is going on in a person's life. Now, speaking of snakes and animals, you go on to make some specific distinctions about the significance of pets in our dreams. What can you tell us about that?
Pets, they are... Of course, nowadays they're like members of the family. You know, what I like to say, cats and dogs are the most common. And cats and dogs usually represent affection, okay? It's not great love, but it's affection. You know, pets, they listen well, they don't talk back, and they're furry besides. What more do you want? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cats tend to go more with women, being feline. Dogs tend to go more with men. Cats are independent. They're sensuous. The dogs are loyal. They can be protectors. They're frequently guardians, that kind of thing. They're complicated animals, but when you hear a story about a pet, there's something about the affections, probably at home, that are being affected.
Okay, yeah, that's a really interesting key, as you say.
Yeah.
Now, I was shocked, surprised, and pleased to come across a reference on page 37 of your book to my interview with Tom Elsner on fairy tales and dreams. So thank you very much for that attribution to Shrink Wrap Radio and me and providing the URL for the show.
Yeah, I love that podcast.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
me too.
It was a very complex fairy tale, and I wanted the opportunity, and he well showed, and you well showed, how a dream could be looked at from a Jungian perspective and be taken apart and really be beneficial to people.
Yeah, I think I probably need to have him on again. So many great ideas for interviews and interviewees and so little time. Now, there are certain dream motifs that are regarded as universal and very common, and one of those is the flying dream. How do you approach flying dreams?
Flying dreams are always significant, you know. And, of course, again, the type of flight makes such a difference. There's everything from jumping high to flying like Superman, which is sort of like is the ultimate. And I had noticed fairly early on, simply because flying dreams are so dramatic, that often I would have a client who, if they suddenly had a dream like they were Superman, usually their life was going to change significantly within a year and a half, okay? That it was a sign that they were feeling personally powerful. Now, the only caveat I would add to that is the exception would be if somebody's bipolar and they're having a manic episode.
Yeah.
They're overestimating their power.
Good point.
You know. I listened to lots of different things, of course, to get different ideas. And I was listening to this person, and they were describing out-of-body experiences. And I've never had an out-of-body experience. I mainly focus on trying to have in-body experiences.
Right.
Someone asked him, after he had presented, what's the most similar thing in a dream that you can experience that's similar to an out-of-body experience? He said, oh, that's easy. Flying. Okay. And that, and his contention was these experiences do have an effect on the outside world. And so I just thought it was interesting that there was a convergence that I wasn't imagining, but, you know, that was taking place, and it surprised me.
Yeah. Let's have you read another dream. How about 6C and its interpretation for us? And it's so nice that you have labeled all of these.
This one is kind of humorous. It's called Shock the Monkey. I think there was a song called that, wasn't there?
I don't know.
A 43-year-old man dreamt that he was trying to soar with a hang glider that allowed him to literally take flight by hanging on to a steel bar while the kite-like apparatus propelled him through the air. He dreamt that there were numerous monkeys having sex all around him, interfering with the flight. A huge sexual orgy of monkeys surrounded his attempt to fly. It makes it difficult to fly, doesn't it? The interpretation, animals in dreams, of course, always represent basic instincts. Monkeys are the animal that most closely resemble human beings. The dream was saying in very graphic terms, and dreams will say things to shock us, to get our attention, that his sexual impulses were interfering with his making progress and soaring in life. This man was promiscuous without involving his emotions, which is harmful to the relationships and to his own psyche. In no uncertain terms, the dream was telling him to quit monkeying around. I almost feel guilty about the pun there.
That's great. Now, lucid dreams often involve flying, and it's sometimes the first thing a person wants to do when they realize that they have become lucid in a dream. I was interested to read that you're not a fan of lucid dreaming.
Well, I should probably qualify that a little bit. I mean, it is the fad, not the fad, but of course people are interested when you have the effect of you suddenly realize in a dream that you're dreaming and you can do things. You know, I think, unfortunately, too much of the time and too much of the motivation for doing that frequently is to use the subconscious as a playground, and it can be an invasion of the subconscious by the conscious. And typically the two things people want to do is either fly or have
fun. Yeah, right.
Okay.
Just like in real life.
You know, I was interested to learn that Buddhist monks, they very much want to have lucid dreams, but their goal is very different. They are actually trying to talk to the archetypes, okay?
Yes.
It's very serious. It's you know, people, there's dreams that I call vision dreams, and I think those come closest to what I would call serious lucid dreams. It feels like the person is actually there talking to you. I feel like I'm actually there talking to them. And this often occurs after someone dies, where you actually feel that the person is there and you can deal with this. But, I mean, the Buddhists will talk to archetypal figures, usually sacred figures, about the meaning of life and so forth. And it's a much different thing than, gee, I think I'll see if I can fly, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, your book is full of examples that come from your work with patients in therapy. What do you see as the role and value of dream work in therapy? I think some therapists look on it as a waste of time, or they don't trust themselves, feeling that their education hasn't prepared them for this type of work. What's the value? Why should therapists maybe reconsider?
I use it all the time. I have people come to me. You meet them for one session, they're in crisis, they don't know what to do, okay, they want you to give an opinion, okay, which you could do, I guess, but you really don't know enough most of the time to be able to do that. What I like to do is to get the person into dreaming, talk about the dream incubation process, have them ask their subconscious the question, and let's see what kind of answer we get. And you know, if you do that incubation procedure and you do that night after night for a week, we're going to get some kind of answer. I've seldom ever not gotten an answer.
Well, dream incubation is a topic that you take up toward the end of the book. And again, you've got kind of your own specific approach to it. Tell us, what are the instructions that you give to your clients?
Yes, just basically before you go to sleep, within a half hour of going to sleep, I want you to formulate the question in your mind. And I might suggest what the question would be, but I want them to put it in their own words, okay? I more or less suggest the area they might want to question, and they have to formulate their own question. And then I want them to write the dream down three times, and the purpose of that is not to keep a record of it. The purpose of that is to register it in their subconscious. But the most important thing, and I emphasize this, is that in the morning, when you wake up, I don't care if you dreamt about Daffy Duck. I want to hear it. Because if your subconscious did a really good job, it's not recognizable what it's talking about usually.
Yeah. Now, you shared with us one instance of dream incubation in your own life when you wanted to go on a run and you were looking for a sign that it would be okay. Is there another instance that you can recall where dream incubation worked in your own personal life?
With my MS, again, there was a controversial medication. I was getting quite bad, quite serious with the symptoms. And basically, they wanted to try a medication called naltrexone. And there were red flags on it. It was thought that it would be helpful for serious cases, but it could affect your heart. Now, I used to be a long-distance runner, and tell me anything but that you're going to affect my heart. And I could accept that if the effect were temporary, but this effect on your heart could be permanent.
Wow.
But things were getting serious enough, and they thought it might be helpful, so I did try to incubate a dream. And I got a dream of taking cough medicine and throwing up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's not much interpretation needed for that dream.
Right.
So. Okay.
Perhaps you can read another dream for us. 34A, which you have titled Save the Kitty, and also okay. Share the interpretation, if you will.
Okay. Save the Kitty. A 43-year-old woman dreamt she went into a public ethnic marketplace that was empty. She could hear the squealing cries of a mother cat for her kittens. She somehow found a bowl, which she filled with milk. She never saw the mother cat. After she scrubbed the bowl, a beautiful kitten emerged from the liquid milk. As she reached to remove the kitten from the milk, a green serpent with a snake like hers, ominously crouched in the milk, getting ready to strike.
Wow, that's very dramatic. What was the interpretation?
Well, her situation was that she had to pass a test in order to leave her current job for a more financially rewarding employment. She inexplicably had failed the test twice, although she knew the material very well. This dream was the result of her incubating a dream by writing the question, "Why am I having trouble passing this test?" three times before going to sleep. There's some very subconscious about writing. We do it quickly, and we do it without much forethought. The purpose of writing it down, again, is to ingrain it in subconscious, and it makes it more likely the dreamer will have a dream that addresses the issue. In the dream, the commercial public marketplace indicated that the dream was about her work life. That's in reference to it occurring in a marketplace. The mother cat that she never saw represented her thought that she should give birth to a new aspect of her instincts. Kittens frequently represent affectionate feelings and frequently refer to female affections. Again, not necessarily so, but frequently so. She was having difficulty leaving her current job because of the many good friends there, the affection amongst them. The most important part is for the dreamer to write down whatever they remember, whatever it is, upon waking. Even if the dream is about something silly like Porky Pig, it's likely to be related to the incubation question. The subconscious uses its own logic. That became clearly discernible to me after attempting to interpret dreams for about 25 years. My thought is that this book will help you lessen the time to your own inner dream interpretation epiphanies. She liked her current workplace and felt nurtured within it. Cleaning the bowl and putting milk in it was her preparing herself for a new workplace. The beautiful kitten was the dream trying to reassure her that she could find a new and fond place with nurturing and affectionate feelings. Snakes, for me, typically represent change, as they are one of the few animals to completely shed their skin. Green is a color of growth. The dream was saying that she was afraid that if she reached out for a job change, that the change and growth might destroy the support and nurture that she desired from her workplace.
Yeah, that really puts it very succinctly. Well, as we begin to wind down here, maybe we can finish up by going through one of the things in one of the last chapters of your book where you say there are five different kinds of dreams. So perhaps you can take us through each of those just briefly and kind of what their implications are.
Okay. The first type of dream, I would try to list them in order. There's, of course, the symbolic dreams, which is the type of dreams we've been discussing, where, things stand for certain things and they relate to current conflicts and are like the dreams that I've been reading.
Okay.
The second type of dream is the post-traumatic stress dream. And this is really just a vivid memory that's stamped in the person's subconscious. It's usually a nightmare. And in fact, having nightmares is diagnostic of having PTSD usually. There's dreams of desire. And I guess I could illustrate this best by children have dreams of desire. They frequently would just have an image of the object that they want, and it's fairly direct.
So they might have a dream about an ice cream cone.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then there is dream visions that I mentioned, that basically you feel like the person that has passed away is standing there in front of you, giving you the message. And maybe one of the most interesting type of dreams is the predictive dreams, okay? And this is, I think, many times your subconscious is making its best estimate of what's likely to happen in the future. And I've actually had psychics in therapy who would have quite stunning predictions of worldwide events, in the news.
Yeah. Yeah, so that raises the question of where are you in terms of, you know, these dream visions in which they're on the surface of it, it seems like there's contact with somebody who's died, that there's some kind of contact with, quotes, the other world or the predictive dream. I get the impression that you're a bit agnostic on that as to whether there really is something else out there or not.
Yeah, I could give a dramatic example of that if you'd like.
Yeah, do.
Early in my career, I had a man who was having panic attacks every day. The situation was that his family was going to go to a family reunion, and it was his sister, his mother, his children, a sibling of his, and they were all loaded into this van, and he said, "Oh, I forgot something at the house. Why don't you go ahead, and I will meet you there. I will take the other car." And the van that his family, entire family, was in was hit head-on by a semi, and everybody was killed.
Wow.
And I wanted to say he understandably was having panic attacks every day. We tried this and that. We tried behavioral things. This is very early in my career. I finally said to him, "Well, why don't you start keeping track of your dreams? Sometimes dreams will tell us what's going on in the back of your mind." So he came in the next session and said, "Well, I no longer have panic attacks." I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, I will tell you that this was a dream, but I want to tell you it did not feel like a dream." He was very close to the sister. The sister was only 1 year difference in age from him. He was very close to her, and he had a vision that she appeared to him, and she explained to him that that they were all doing well in another place, that he should not be worried that, you know, it was instant. Their deaths were instant. They did not suffer. And she emphasized that their wish for him expressly was for him just to go on and live a good life.
And so that experience reassured him to such an extent that his panic symptoms disappeared.
He never had another panic attack.
Yeah.
He asked me, "What do you think? Do you think it was a dream or do you think it was real?" And I mostly avoided the question and said, "You know what? I don't really care. The main thing is that you don't have that anymore." Okay. But I do want to say, I was quite amazed. I read a book by a Jungian analyst, and I actually got CEUs for this book that was about how loved ones that have died tend to appear in people's dreams for up to 2 years after their death. Okay.
Yeah.
And was talking about what to expect, and they were talking about the problem is sometimes the person here is holding on too much, and sometimes the problem the person that died is holding on too much. But it was very interesting to me, of course. But we don't know everything, do we?
No, we don't. And so for me, that's kind of an open question, too. Although, you know, I've had experiences that of what feel to me like precognitive dreams, nothing major like a world disaster or anything like that. But precognitive dreams and synchronicities, those two things are within my body of experience that keep reminding me that there may be more going on than meets the eye.
You know, Carl Jung, he emphasized that so much. And I think, you know, he kept emphasizing when you see that happening, something significant is occurring. And in your life, in my life, in many people's lives, you know, that seems to be the case. It's uncanny. It strikes you, how could this what are the odds of that happening that way?
Yeah. Well, we should probably wrap it up here. So do you have any last thought that you'd like to share?
Just emphasizing the value of dreams and how they can be used practically. I'm hoping to give people a method in my book, Dreams Guide to the Soul. I think it's been helpful to other people. I'm hoping other people can benefit from it as well.
Yeah, great. Well, Dr. Stephen Fox, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And I want to thank you for this podcast and the wonderful work you do, and I think it's great.
I'm glad I thought to ask Stephen how he first heard about Shrink Wrap Radio. I wish I remembered to do that more often, because I do sometimes wonder how it is that people are finding the show. Are they using a Google search? Are they hearing about it from friends or colleagues? It really had not occurred to me that the CE courses I've been offering through the Zur Institute might also be a conduit to discovering the show. And as you heard, I was surprised and delighted to discover that both Stephen and I had come through the graduate program at the University of Montana in Missoula. I think this is the first time that I've encountered anyone else in the world who had gone through that program. And the other surprising and delightful thing was discovering his reference to my interview with Tom Elsner as I was reading through his book. I think his book is a very interesting contribution to the literature on dream interpretation. His 40 keys cover the familiar bases of a Jungian approach to understanding the meaning of dreams, but he goes beyond these to add his own very creative and insightful elaborations. Also, the book is chock full of patient dreams and his interpretations. Just reading through those will be very instructive to all, whether amateur or professional. As always, you can use the Amazon widget on our site to order Dreams Guide to the Soul by Stephen Fox.
Dr. Dave is one of the most generous persons I know of. Every Thursday, I get spoiled with a new interview which David has been working on all week and for which he asks nothing in return but that we contemplate what his work is worth for us. So I did. And I realized I was hooked. A good measure of how much you value something is your reaction to your imagine it disappear. So I try to picture the day when Shrink Wrap Radio doesn't exist anymore. And what I felt was sorrow, almost as if an old friend had passed away. So maybe you, like me, value the work of our dear old shrink more than you think. My response to that was a small donation. Was yours going to be?
Thank you, Oscar in Sweden, for that very heartfelt call to action. I guess my generosity does have its limits, though. I've considered requiring at least a modest subscription fee. Instead of making a technological requirement to access the content, however, I've decided to do it on an honor code basis, if you will. So let's say that the basic subscription fee is $12 a year. As I mentioned last time, I've added a new support option called the guilt-free level for $12 a year. Or maybe I should have called it the good karma option. Either way, that comes out to be $1 a month for access to all 381 episodes plus all the transcripts. Now, keeping all this going has turned into the equivalent of a half-time job for me. If everyone who enjoys the benefit of my labor were to at least subscribe at this guilt-free slash good karma level of $12 a year, that would actually generate a reasonable half-time salary. Now, I assume there's no one out there who can't afford a dollar a month. If you're listening to this show, I assume you either have been able to afford a computer or a smartphone or a tablet, so surely you can spare $1 a month for this content that you enjoy. please go to the support page on our site and enjoy guilt-free listening. And, of course, you should also feel free to join those who are supporting at a higher level, but at the very least, spring for $1 a month. And I thank you. Oh, and by the way, as an added bonus to all those of you who help to financially support Shrink Wrap Radio, I've created an honor roll page, which you can get to by mousing over the support tab. This page shows the names of all our financial contributors for 2013 and will be updated annually. So I'd love to see your name on our honor roll. We have one new transcript on the site, once again, lovingly done by champion transcriber Gloria Ullman. It's number 377, Dispelling the Ghosts Who Run Our Lives, with Jungian analyst James Hollis. Now, Gloria has recently transcribed a whole bunch of shows, and she's let me know that she needs to take a break for a while. And I would say it's a well-deserved one. So please contact me if you'd like to step up to the plate and transcribe one of your favorite episodes. Finally, please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. And I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, Facebook, Google+, or Twitter.
This is Josh C. from San Jose. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Josh C. I hope you're still out there somewhere listening. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Brandon with a guest request. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, longtime fan. I imagine you get many recommendations, and here's another. I would like to recommend my Zen teacher, Larry Christensen. He teaches in the Soto Zen tradition under the Ordinary Mind School founded by Charlotte Joko Beck, and he is a practicing therapist with a PsyD and psychoanalytic training. He's pretty rad and holds great wisdom in self-compassion, kindness, and the rocky road of being. Regards, Brandon." Well, Brandon, I will take that under advisement. Brandon sent me some links to the Zen teacher's website, and I'll be checking those out and taking that under consideration and adding it to my long and growing list of possible interview guests. The next one is from Stockholm listener and friend Michelle, who also has a guest request and also of a spiritual nature. She writes, "Dear David, this is just another short message that I'm reading a book by Paul Gilbert, Compassion-Focused Therapy, which I think you may find interesting. Compassion plus CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, plus Buddhism, plus Jung. I'll say no more. Kristen Neff mentioned him and his research team on a Wise Counsel interview. Cheers," and that's from Michelle. So, Michelle, I say the same thing to you that I did to Brandon. I've got it on my big, long guest to-do list. So we'll see what happens. Everything comes around eventually. The next one is from Mark, who writes in response to my thanks for his financial donation. And he writes, "Hi, Dave. My recent financial shot in the arm to you was to express my ongoing appreciation for the good work that you do to find and share the thought leaders in our industry with us. I'm a new counselor working on establishing my own theoretical orientation, and I've found your archives and ongoing interviews invaluable in my continuing education. Your forum has helped me to zero in on the theories, reading, and training I use in my practice every day. Keep up the good work, Dave. I very much appreciate what you do." And that's from licensed professional counselor Mark Lunderie in Columbus, Ohio. And Mark, again, I thank you for your contribution. Your name has been added to the honor roll. And keep working away on your theoretical orientation. And maybe some years down the road, when it's nice and ripe, I'll have you on as a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Stephen Fox, for sharing his creative approach to dream interpretation. On the next episode, I'll return to the topic of sensory experiencing, and my guest will be Dr. Lawrence Heller, and we'll be discussing his work on healing developmental trauma. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.